Welcome to Apparently, the podcast for absolutely average parents. I'm Ann Johnsos.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Ann and I have been friends for a very long time.
We met right after college.
Yeah, and our first jobs as radio producers.
We spent our 20s as wing women for each other, and it didn't work out very well.
But then it did, and we found the right guys and stood up in each other's weddings.
And then we had babies within weeks of each other, so we went from producers to reproducers.
We make it look easy.
Which brings us to this podcast. We want to discuss topics that interest us and you and provide some knowledge to other average parents.
We're average, not experts. So we'll tackle these topics with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, we'll get the experts. And I fully expect to embarrass myself along the way.
Yeah, after season one, I'm pretty sure we already have.
So welcome to Apparently.
We make it look easy. We make it look good. When everybody sees it, they stop and take a look.
Apparently, times are a-changin', Ann. Did you know in 1950, 12% of women with children under 5 were in the workforce?
Okay.
Now, check this out. In 2017, 65% of women with children under 5 are in the workforce.
It went from 12% to 65% of women with
kids? Yes, like five times as many women are working and have children under 5.
Wow.
So that's a pretty monumental shift, right?
Yep.
And yet, when you think about it, the policies and attitudes haven't really shifted to keep pace with our family's current realities with working and having families and small kids.
And needing two incomes, essentially, right?
Exactly. This was another statistic I saw that I thought was startling. 11 million American children younger than 5 spend half their waking hours in the care of someone else.
Wow.
Think wow. About. Which, so with that alone, that statistic, it makes you pause. And I thought this would be a good topic to talk about early education. I read somewhere that one economist said that you won't find a better public return than investing in early childhood public education.
Right.
Amen. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a huge proponent of quality public education.
Yep.
I put my money where my mouth is, literally, and I'm a school board member. I'm very involved in my local schools and my kids' education, and I've been very blessed and fortunate to be the main caregiver in my house mm-hmm. for my kids. So I've never had to deal with childcare or babysitters. So I was one of the fortunate few after watching this new documentary called No Small Matter. I have a renewed interest and appreciation for working families and who are struggling to make ends meet and to provide the best for their kids.
Yeah. So, and on the flip side of that, when my girls were little, I was teaching at Northwestern.
Yep.
And I had to hire sitters, not 40 hours a week or more, but a few 8-hour days. And our first sitter has kids of her own now, and we're friends on, you know, Facebook and Insta. You know, she was a wonderful sitter. She kept journals. She wrote down things they said and things they did.
Awesome.
So when I got home, my kids would be like, yay, we can watch a show, because they knew that I was going to be distracted. Like, I was busy working even when I was home. And to be honest, I didn't make more than I paid. I mean, we broke even so that I could keep my foot
yep.
in the door.
Yes.
Because I knew that at some point they would be old enough to be in school, and I didn't want to be without
options. That's why
options.
I stayed home. Because it wouldn't make sense. Like, I would be working to pay for somebody to watch my kids.
Right.
So I know I bore you with education talk and policy and all that stuff, but with as much as I talk about all of this, you'd think I was a teacher, but I could never hack being a teacher. Not for one single day. The stuff that they do in the classroom and the magic that they make happen is just overwhelming. I can't believe it. At the end of the year, like, wow, they've grown so much.
Yes, and we are recording this at the end of the Chicago Public Schools school year, and I can just see these teachers walking in with, like, oh, please let me get through this last couple days. You know, like, you know, I used to say limping across the finish line. I think they're now army crawling across the finish line.
Yeah, going commando.
just trying to get there.
You always make fun. You've said this before that I always say knowledge is power. You're like, you say that all the time, Tracy. But it's actually true. When you know better, you do better, right? So when scientists, psychologists, and educators all talk about the virtues of early education learning, why as a society is it so hard to support working parents if we know what needs to be done? right? Like, if we know that early intervention and early childhood education is so important, what the hell is the problem?
I think the question is, where do we start? How do we start?
Yeah. So in 28, this was, I did all kinds of research for this. In 28 states, childcare costs more than college.
Oh my gosh.
So when you're under 5 years old, that costs more than when you're 18 going off to school.
That's crazy.
It's one of the most expensive necessities for working families, and the cost of childcare forces families to choose between paying for someone to watch your kids, like you and I both did. We decided after producing, like, are we going to go back or simply just not to work. The average annual cost of childcare is more than $20,000 in most parts of the country.
That's a salary for some people.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, we decided to bring in an old friend. Mm-hmm. He's a documentary film writer and co-director, Greg Jacobs, to talk about his film, No Small Matter. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
So we both watched the documentary, and I loved it because it's all about kids and education. What was the impetus for the documentary? Like, why do a film about early education?
So, when we started this, I really didn't even know that it was an issue, something that people talk about in this way. The whole thing got started for me and my co-directors, John Siskel and Danny Alpert, all have kind of different origin stories for this. But for me, it was, we were asked by an organization called the Ounce of Prevention Fund, which is like a big early learning advocacy organization based in Chicago, to do a video for their annual luncheon. And so as part of the video, they sent us down to their EduCare facility on the South Side, which is like this incredible early learning center with like amazing teachers and great families, all for low-income folks on the South Side. And after a week there, I was so amazed by the work that the teachers did, that by the engagement of the parents, and just by like the light in the kids' eyes, that I kind of thought, why hasn't anybody told me about this before?
Yeah.
And I had written a book about school desegregation in my hometown, which is Columbus, Ohio. And I had kind of given up on K-12. Like, the battles are so fierce and nothing ever moves. And this sort of made me think, well, what if the one thing we haven't tried is making the raw material that comes into the school system better? Mm-hmm. And like imagining the change and the ripple effect if you had a kindergarten class where, you know, 20 of the 25 kids were there and ready to learn instead of 5 or 10. And just thinking about what a huge difference that would make in everything kind of made me a convert to this cause right away. Uh-huh. And from then it was sort of like, all right, let's figure out how do we tell the big story.
The film talks about the importance of the first 3 years of life.
Oh, yeah, this was good.
Yeah, that the brain develops faster than at any other time. And one of the most amazing shots is of a scientist and a newborn facing each other. And the baby mimics the scientist. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Andy Meltoff is the scientist. He's a psychology professor in Washington. And he did a bunch of experiments many years ago where it would be him and, like, the newest newborn you could find. Mm-hmm. So the babies, there's one I think that's 42 minutes old.
Yeah, freshy.
And freshy, totally fresh, wrinkly and all those things.
Goopy.
And he would just kind of interact with them by, you know, opening his mouth and closing it, or
sticking his tongue out.
Sticking his tongue out, that kind of thing. And the babies who had never seen, you know, their own face before, it's not like there are mirrors in the womb.
Yeah.
You know, somehow knew that this part of their body was the thing to move, and that interaction was what, you know, it prompted. And for Meltoff and for others, I think it showed a few things. It showed that babies are born learning right from the start. There's no like blank slate period. That they learn really from the people who are the experts in the world around them, the people who are keeping them alive and protecting them, which is the big people, the grown-ups.
Yeah.
And then that there's like so much going on there at that point that it is really this interaction, it's this back and forth, that's the thing that's going to ultimately kind of shape the healthy brain. And so it makes you realize just right off the bat how important all of this is.
Exactly. I love the sticking the tongue out and the, I was, oh, yeah. I was like, Because I don't remember doing it that little. Like, I remember when they're, like, 8 months old or something doing it. But these babies were literally just born.
Yep.
And they were doing
yep.
it.
Yep.
My kid didn't I open their eyes.
You probably weren't in, like, the condition to do an experiment.
How'd you know, Greg?
Yeah, just a hunch.
Yeah. So does early education mean learning, like, the ABCs? What are we, like, or what does it mean exactly?
That's something that a lot of people, it's one of the things that we really want to do with the film is really help people redefine what this is. Mm-hmm. Because even the term early childhood education, as soon as people hear education, they immediately associate it with school. And so they think that must be pre-K. And pre-K is definitely important, but it's just a small part of what we are framing early childhood as. And what's really important is not so much like cramming a kid's head full of information, but it's really those relationships. It's really that back and forth that the experiment showed. So that, like, you know, reading to a child is great and super important, but it's not because of the information that you're imparting to the one-year-old or two-year-old. That's, you know, that's good. But it's really like the explosion that's going on in the baby's brain because mom or dad or whoever is sitting there with them and having this back and forth.
Correct.
So we're just trying to make people sort of see this through the filter of it's not school, it's not tests, it's this whole ecosystem of relationships that a child has at this crucial moment in their lives that really builds the brain.
Experiences.
Yeah, exactly. It's experiences and supportive, loving relationships and all that good stuff. The more of that, the better.
So you talk about in the film and show it beautifully. I don't know how you did that where you sort of showed how to build the brain. But you talk about the communications developing pathways. And so the more communication, the more stimulation, the stronger the pathways and the stronger the brain. What happens if a baby's brain is not stimulated like that?
So there's like two parts to that. One is the brain grows. The brain is this weird organ that doesn't come out fully formed. I think it's something like 25% adult size when you're born, and then 70% by the time you're one, and then 85 or 90% adult size by the time you're five. But it's always growing and building. And so, you know, there's like a million connections being made every second in an infant's brain. And if that kept going like that, it would just totally overwhelm it. You'd be like crazy. Alison Gopnik talks about it as being like drinking 8 espressos and being in a foreign country. No idea what's going on, but you're so excited. So at a certain point, the brain then says, all right, we got to stop this. And we cut everything back. It's called pruning. And that allows you to start focusing on things and being able to concentrate and really being able to do things you need to do as a human being in the world. So the pathways that are created in those first few years then get built on and built on and built on. And if those pathways are strong and if they're, you know, you have great loving experiences and supportive adults in your life and whatever, then the stuff that is built on top of that is built on a really strong foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But if that interaction isn't there, if there's something missing, you're not getting the strong foundation. And it makes everything that gets built on top of it a little bit more fragile and then progressively more and more fragile if it doesn't get fixed. So that's part of it, which is not getting enough of the good stuff. But there's another piece of it that people need to understand, I think, which is that, like, if you're the baby in caveman times and somebody's not interacting with you or you're not around people, that kind of means you're a goner. And so that has been wired into our brains, that there's something wrong if the grown-ups in your life at that stage are not connecting with you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still with us. And so what happens, what the brain does, is it sends out all kinds of hormonal chemical signals to say, like, do whatever you can to get attention and to make sure there are people around.
Mm-hmm.
And if those chemicals and those hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, things like that, keep pumping out and don't have anything to stop it, then it starts to actually corrode the brain. So all this stress that happens in a baby's life, if there's neglect or abuse or there's drug abuse in the home or all kinds of other challenges, can create like a vicious cycle where the body stays on high alert all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine like, a sprinkler that keeps pumping out water long after the ground is saturated. That's what's happening in the body. And it's really, really unhealthy. So the babies are getting too much of the, not enough of the good stuff and too much of the bad stuff.
This goes to our next question, which is about sort of how you broke down the film. And I think you were just talking about toxic stress, but let's go through the four parts of the film. Trace?
I broke down into four parts: the healthy brain development, closing the achievement gap, executive function with Cookie Monster. I love that. Mm-hmm. And toxic stress. Those were the elements and how you broke down the benefits of the high quality early education programs.
So we talked about healthy brain development from early on. Does that lead to closing the achievement gap?
Yeah. So if you don't get enough of that good stuff, you know, what happens is that by the time you get to, say, kindergarten, maybe you just, you know, you don't have, you're not equipped with those tools. So in particular, there's between like high-income children and low-income families, high-income folks who may have access to all these experiences and resources, and the kids' brains can sometimes be as much as 2 years ahead in terms of like reading comprehension language comprehension.
Wow.
And abilities and things like that. So there is a deficit through no fault of the kid's own by any means, and really no fault of the parents' own either. There's a deficit that starts in kindergarten, and the studies have shown that it doesn't close, or it doesn't get better and doesn't get worse by the time they graduate from high school. So you're basically 2 years behind
forever,
and then you get to forever. And that is just, I mean, that's the immoral is the word I always use to describe that.
And also think about it. If you are 2 years behind, your attitude toward school is going to be dramatically different because you're going to feel that and you're not going to want to learn or you're going to be so frustrated. So it's compounded.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of thing where, the kids really, you know, you can only learn if you feel safe and you feel secure. And certainly having, you know, the confidence that you belong there is part of that. And, it becomes a real vicious cycle if you don't have that. And there's, you know, it's one of the things that we always want to be clear about is that the brain is plastic, which means it's changeable.
Yep.
And you can always, you know, with intensive effort, rectify that. But that effort is really hard and it costs a lot of money and it's kind of stupid to do it after the fact, instead of getting it right the first time.
Exactly. Early intervention.
Yeah.
So, Greg, explain executive function, because that was an interesting part, and that is a big part of what makes classrooms successful, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things I think we realized with the film was that you have to answer two questions. You have to say, why is early childhood experiences and early education, why is it important? And that's the brain development stuff and all that. But also, why is it important now? Like, why is it something that we talk about so much now and we didn't talk about when we were kids, or nobody talked about when we were kids? And part of that is that the changing workforce, education is so much more important to getting a job where you can support a family here. And you need certain skills in that job market. You need to be able to collaborate and you need to be able to work with others and need to be able to operate computers, all that stuff. So that is all executive function. And that's more important now than it was 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
A lot more factory jobs and that kind of thing. So turns out that executive function is rooted in a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which comes online around age 3 and doesn't stop growing, as anybody who has teenagers knows, until you're about 25. So those first few years are when a lot of this foundation is getting wired in for the skills you need later on in school and then in the workplace. So I think schools are starting to really understand that we need to focus on building those skills, because if you can't sit still and you can't remember things and you can't follow instructions and all that kind of stuff, then it's really hard to concentrate. It's really hard to learn anything.
Correct.
So teachers, it seems like, would much rather have kids who have those skills coming into kindergarten than who know how to read or know the alphabet or whatever.
The way you showed that in the movie was hilarious. You had an interview with someone, and then she was interrupted by a famous furry friend. Do you want to explain that one?
So, spoiler alert.
Oh, wait, Greg, do you want me not to talk about that?
No, fine. We've opened the door. You know, it's Cookie Monster time. Yeah, we thought, you know, who is the greatest representative of the challenge of executive function in early learning? And that, you know, eventually you're going to come to Cookie Monster. And so we have Cookie Monster, who interrupts the interview with the Sesame Workshop woman, and then is essentially told that if he can hold on and be patient, he will get a whole plate of cookies, which yes. makes Cookie Monster obviously super excited.
Giddy.
So then he does a couple of different tasks. And it's funny because I know that people will see the movie and they'll remember some of this stuff. And hopefully it'll change the way they see the world. But the one thing that nobody will ever forget is Cookie Monster doing karaoke to Total Eclipse of the Heart. That's like...
Yes.
We're doomed to that.
Hey, if that's the mark you leave on the world, I think you're okay.
It is something. But it was really hard. We had to actually kind of edit around me laughing in that moment because we had him do a number of different songs, and that was really the one that was the killer.
That was great.
The clincher. What about toxic stress?
You were starting to talk about that with a buildup of the hormones.
Yeah. So toxic stress is something I think that it's a challenge to understand because it sounds like a disease.
Yeah.
It sounds like something you can catch.
Yeah.
Or is contagious. But really, it's just a way of describing the body's reaction to constant stress unalleviated by an adult presence or an adult, a supportive adult.
Right.
So in those, you know, in the body, if something happens in your 1-year-old or 2-year-old, you're basically counting on something goes wrong. There's a grown-up who is going to scoop you up and let you know everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, make you feel safe.
Make you feel safe, make you feel loved, all of that. And that's how the body calibrates the stress response system. And we all need the stress response system. I mean, it's like as someone says in the film, people who didn't develop that evolutionarily, they got eaten.
Yes.
Right.
So they're not around.
Yes.
So we need to develop that. But if that, as we talked about, if that keeps going unchecked, and if there isn't a grown-up who can kind of help teach you how to turn it on and off just through their responses, then it starts to do really bad things to the body. And the amazing thing to me was not like just that it sort of corrodes brain circuits and affects the way you can learn, but that it also affects all these other developing systems in the body. So it comes out not just in learning and kindergarten readiness and things like that, but decades later in, you know, how likely you are to get heart disease or diabetes or even commit suicide. So it has these incredibly long-lasting kind of hidden impacts on the body that are, like, just kind of mind-boggling. Like, you'd never think what's happening to you as a 2-year-old would rebound 50 years later.
Exactly.
But it does.
Right. So I was reading in education, I subscribe to all these blogs and so on, and one of these periodicals I was reading said that an economist said that every dollar invested in early childhood saves $4 because children who participate in early education are less likely to require special education services, or they're less likely to end up in the costly juvenile justice system. That was striking to me because, you know, investing in childhood, early childhood education, I believe you even talked about that in the film, didn't you? How much the United States spends?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that we don't do this, but, you know, the numbers vary. There's $4, some people say $7, some people say $3.50, whatever. It's sort of like the exact number doesn't really matter. It's just that there's so much evidence that shows that this is the best public investment we can make. This has the best return. Because of all the things you mentioned, like if we do it early and get it right, we're paying so much less over time than we would if we get it wrong and we have to fix it. And the thing is, because of, you know, we were just talking about the health impacts, like I think those numbers are going to keep going up, that return on investment. Because if you think about, you know, if we can prevent toxic stress in, you know, a certain percentage of children, and that reduces, like, heart disease by 1%. That's billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's big money.
It's big money. And it also, you know, it's not just the kids that it helps, too. It's the parents. And this is something that they're just starting to understand is how much the parent stress and the children stress are this kind of cycle that affect each other. So if you get the parents less stressed and you can get them to engage more with the kids, it helps the kids, and you know, emotionally and biologically. And then the kids become calmer and they're kind of like, oh, this is kind of nice. And that makes the parents go, maybe I can do this. And it becomes this virtuous cycle that makes things better and better. So it's not just about helping the kids with toxic stress. It's always about helping the parents as well.
Right. In the film, it was helping empowering the parent, the one mom who was going to classes.
Avance?
Yeah.
In Waco, Texas, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's a great program. And there are so many programs like this that are doing this, where it's really, you know, it's about getting the parents to have some confidence in their abilities, more information than they might have had about what helps, and then a little hope. And you just start to see the impact, like, blossom.
Yes.
I can be a good parent, and my kid can maybe have a better life than me.
Exactly. It was contagious, like, in the room when you saw her in the class with all the other moms. It was really cute.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
So one group you profiled was called Mission Readiness, and it was an unlikely group in my head.
I didn't know where that was going at all at first.
Because these are all retired veterans pushing for early education. It's like a whole bunch of old white dudes. So what's behind that?
It's funny. That's the other thing that people really remember, is that all of a sudden these military guys are talking about babies. It's like, what is going on? This is upside down land.
Yeah.
So they are an organization, and they actually have what they call unlikely champions. So it's evangelical ministers, sports figures, all kinds of different people that you may not expect to be speaking out about early childhood. But the military folks have kind of a double interest in it. The stat that everybody remembers is that 71% of people ages 17 to 25 wouldn't be allowed to be in the military even if they wanted to, because they're not educated enough, they have physical problems, they have a criminal record, all the things that early childhood helps with.
Yeah, that was huge.
71%,
which is crazy. So if you think about, like, early childhood education, getting this right for kids and families as a as like a military thing, as a national security issue, it's really interesting. So that's part of their interest, is in making sure that in an all-volunteer force, they're getting to pick from the best people possible.
Absolutely.
And if the people aren't qualified, then it just keeps weakening and weakening the force.
And
the other part of it is that the military in the last 30 years has developed probably the best child care system in the country, because they used to have terrible child care. But again, like, for an all-volunteer force, you need perks and you need families to be taken care of. And you need soldiers to not be stressed out thinking about their kids if they're, you know, in battle. So they have built a really, really strong system of early learning and family support. And so they want to keep that going as well. So when you think about that, the military not only sort of gets the importance, but they also really get it right.
Yeah.
You can start thinking about how, maybe we can scale that up, and maybe civilians can have that too.
Can you imagine a day when companies offer, like the military does, on-site daycare? I think about all the big companies that everyone wants to work for and get the free lunches and the workout room and the massages and all this stuff. And those are all great and everything. But for a working parent, like, that doesn't, it's nice, but that's not really what they need.
Totally. I mean, the short answer is I can't imagine that day. I'd love to imagine it, but I can't.
Okay.
And I think part of it is that childcare is such a complicated and difficult and expensive thing that I think it's unlikely that we can assume that companies around the country will take this on. I mean, not because they're bad people, but because maybe we don't even want companies to do that. At the same time, like, it's great when they can and when they do, as long as they extend it to all the employees and not just the highest paid employees, because that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
But if all these companies did other stuff to support families, you know, scheduling that was predictable and regular, or, you know, paid family leave, or maybe subsidies for childcare in your neighborhood, then that would be a total game changer. And one thing I have to say is that the business community is in a lot of ways ahead of this game, much more than others. So there's a huge business interest in this, and that's been great to see. So part of the point of the film is to keep getting this in front of business audiences so that they see how important it is for their workers.
The value and importance.
And for the future of the workforce as well.
Yeah.
So, Greg, let's shift gears a little. You also talk about childcare providers and their salaries. In the film, these preschool teachers, who are fantastic, they're working two jobs, and one of them says people, they treat them like babysitters. How wrong is that? And why aren't they paid more?
Yeah, that's the worst. And the whole movie is, in a way, an argument leading up to that point. That if we understand that relationships are the key to all of this, and that most parents can't take care of their kid at home, that the people who are taking care of the kids had better be good and loving and had better not be stressed themselves. So, you know, the stats on the early childhood workforce are just, like, unbelievable. Something like 46%. Is on public assistance in some way. The average salary is something like $11.50. I don't know, something just really, really low like that. And the turnover is maybe 25 to 30% a year.
Wow. I wanted to go to that preschool. That preschool that you profiled?
Oh, my God.
That looked like the bomb diggity.
That's the best. And to see that magic, like the magic that these incredible teachers create, just dissolve like that because they can't sustain it. It's heartbreaking. It's totally heartbreaking.
They were crying.
They were crying. And, I mean, when you see the film with audiences, they're not the only ones crying. I mean, it's really a powerful thing because all you want is for that person to be in that classroom.
Right, yeah.
Because they're so good.
Yeah.
But it's really heartbreaking. And so, you know, when you think about, like, the workforce who can't afford childcare for their own kids and how stressed they must be and sometimes uninformed and not qualified, that we really need to start paying them more in order to make sure that this incredibly important job is being valued the way it should.
Exactly. At the end of the film, you show statistics about early childhood education. I saw it was supported by Republicans, Democrats, Independents. So what do we need to do? What's the solution to the child care crisis?
Yeah, the great thing about the issue is that it's like the one issue that is and should be nonpartisan,
right,
or at least has people on the Republican side, people on the Democrat side support it, sometimes for different reasons, but they're doing, both sides are doing really interesting things around the country in this. And, you know, I always say that, like, if you can have Republicans and Democrats screaming at each other about something, and if you ran up to them and handed them a baby, they would both respond exactly the same way.
Yeah.
So there's something about the issue that I think can bridge the gap.
And universal.
If it can do that, it then affects so many other issues. It affects criminal justice. It affects healthcare. It affects business. It affects the economy. All of that. That it can have a ripple effect that's way beyond just this issue. So I always, you know, I like always like to point to five buckets that, you know, if you are thinking about this issue, you should make sure that whatever candidate you support has something to say about these five things. And they're prenatal care, home visiting, paid family leave, child care, and pre-K. And that pretty much covers this time period for people. And that those are the, if we can start to shift the focus to those issues, then I think we'll see a huge change.
All right, on a side note, because we have to wrap up, but I want to say how engaging the film is. It sounds like, you know, oh, early childhood education, that will be really boring. But it is so delightful with these babies learning and laughing and being surprised and engaged. And then did you put GoPro cameras on parents and babies?
We did some of that, but it's amazing how many parents actually, on their own accord, put GoPros on babies. We wanted to show... It's a little disturbing, actually. We wanted to show what it looks like, what this interaction looks like from the baby's perspective. So put yourself in the baby's tiny little socks and think about how the big people are looking at you and acting and interacting with you. So it's kind of a wondrous thing to see. So that's great. And there's, you know, we really felt like nobody wants to see 70 minutes of misery when it comes to babies and little kids. Like, that would just be, who could stand that, you know? So we wanted to make sure that it was also funny and entertaining and emotional. So my favorite part, maybe in the whole movie, is when a dad puts a wok on top of his head to try to make the baby laugh. Yeah. And this little chubby baby just immediately turns red and bursts into tears.
Oh, he was distraught. That baby was upset.
Oh my God, it's so funny.
Like, what are you doing to my daddy? You
know, exactly. What is my daddy doing to himself?
Yeah.
So we just wanted to make sure that people also remember, like, why we love kids and how fun they are and how goofy and why we connect with them like that. So I'm glad to hear it was entertaining.
Seeing it in action, seeing the actual preschools and kids, because, you know, when you put your kid in preschool or in childcare, you don't see what goes on. So when you see the interactions and the curiosity and the just general, like, awe and magic of life, like how they just look at, like, digging for a worm or a bug was like the most epic thing they've ever done. And just they're singing and just the no filter things that the kids were saying. It was like you forget the wonder of early childhood, like how everything is so magical. You're not jaded yet.
No, and it's one of my favorite moments is that they find this praying mantis egg and they go through a bunch of learning about it. And this one little kid keeps calling it a tarantula. And the educator's like, okay. And that was the epitome of patience right there.
Yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. Those teachers, Rachel and Tracy and the other teachers in that room, are never anything more than totally 100% present for those kids. They're never looking at their phone or disengaged. It's unbelievable. And all I can ever think is, if I did that for 20 minutes, I would end up like rocking back and forth in the corner of the room, sobbing, going, please take me out of here.
Same.
So they're heroes. They're unbelievable.
Yes. Special people for those
special
roles.
Special people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Greg Jacobs, writer and co-director of No Small Matter. It's being screened across the country, and it starts its Chicago run tomorrow night at the Gene Siskel Film Center. You can find out more at nosmallmatter.com. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, guys. This was great.
Well done. Love it.
Thanks.
So apparently, the push for early childhood education has momentum, but we need to make it a movement. So let's figure out how to close the achievement gap and end intergenerational poverty. We have nothing to lose and pretty much everything to gain, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those early years are pivotal for their futures, for kids' futures.
And for the country's future.
Absolutely. So, Anne, this is the beginning of season 4.
4 seasons, man.
Yeah, episode 1 of season 4.
Yep.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, first of all. If you've been listening since the beginning, if you like what you hear, we would love for you to share our podcast with others and review us on iTunes. We could always use some reviews.
Subscribe.
Yep, absolutely. Share the podcast with your friends. Even that would be fantastic to spread the word about, apparently. And we'd love to hear from you. You can check out our Facebook page. Or give us a call at 331-704-0046.
Or email us at apparentlypodcast@gmail.com. This is a WGN Plus podcast. I'm Ann Johnsos.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Thanks for listening to Apparently. We make it look easy. We make it look good. When everybody's here.